Chapter 12. Roots of Human Violence and Greed. Consciousness Research and Human Survival. Since time immemorial, the propensity toward unbridled violence and insatiable greed have been two elemental forces driving human history. The number and nature of the atrocities that have been committed throughout the ages in various countries of the world, many of them in the name of God, are truly astonishing and shocking. Countless millions of soldiers and civilians have been killed in wars and revolutions and other forms of bloodshed. In the past, these violent events had tragic consequences for the individuals who are directly involved in them and for their immediate families. However, they did not threaten the future of the human species as a whole, and certainly did not represent a danger for the ecosystem and for the biosphere of the planet. Also, during this time, hunting, gathering, and farming were sustainable human activities. Even after the most violent wars, nature was able to recycle all the aftermath and completely recover within several decades. This situation changed very radically over the course of the 20th century due to rapid technological progress, the exponential growth of industrial production and pollution, the massive population explosion, and particularly the development of atomic and hydrogen bombs, chemical and biological warfare, and other weapons of mass destruction. We are facing a global crisis of unprecedented proportions and have the dubious privilege of being the first species in history that has achieved the capacity to eradicate itself and, in the process, threaten the evolution of life on this planet. Diplomatic negotiations, administrative and legal measures, economic and social sanctions, military intervention, and other similar efforts have had very little success. As a matter of fact, they have often produced more problems than they solved. It is obvious why they had to fail. The strategies used to alleviate this crisis are rooted in the same ideology that created it in the first place. And as Albert Einstein pointed out, it is impossible to solve problems with the same level of thinking that created them. It has become increasingly clear that the crisis we are facing reflects the level of consciousness evolution of the human species, and that its successful resolution, or at least alleviation, would have to include a radical inner transformation of humanity on a large scale. The observations that have come from the research of holotropic states of consciousness provide new insights into the nature and roots of human aggression and greed, and may lead to effective strategies for alleviating the destructive and self-destructive tendencies of the human species. Anatomy of Human Destructiveness. The scientific understanding of human aggression began with Darwin's epoch-making book on the evolution of species in the middle of the 19th century. The attempts to explain human aggression from our animal origins generated such theoretical concepts as Desmond Morris's image of the naked ape, Robert Ardrey's idea of the territorial imperative, Paul MacLean's triune brain, and Richard Dawkins' socio-biological explanations interpreting aggression in terms of genetic strategies of the selfish gene. More refined models of behavior, developed by pioneers in ethology, such as Nobel laureates Konrad Lorenz and Nicolaas Tinbergen, complemented the mechanical emphasis on instincts through the study of ritualistic and motivational elements. However, As Erich Fromm demonstrated in his groundbreaking book, Anatomy of Human Destructiveness, any theories asserting that the human disposition to violence simply reflects our animal origins are inadequate and unconvincing. Animals exhibit aggression when they are hungry, competing for sex, or defending their territory. With rare exceptions, such as the occasional violent group raids of the chimpanzees against neighboring groups, animals do not prey on their own kind. The nature and scope of human violence, Erich Fromm's malignant aggression, has no parallels in the animal kingdom. The realization that human aggression cannot be adequately explained as a result of phylogenetic evolution led to the formulation of psychodynamic and psychosocial theories that consider a significant part of human aggression to be learned behavior. This trend began in the late 1930s and was initiated by the work of Dullard and Miller. The authors of psychodynamic theories made attempts to explain the specifically human aggression as a reaction to various psychotraumatic situations that the human infant and child experience during the extended period of dependency, physical, emotional, and sexual abuse, lack of love, sense of insecurity, inadequate satisfaction of basic biological needs, emotional deprivation, abandonment, and rejection. However, explanations of this kind fall painfully short of accounting for extreme forms of individual violence, such as the serial murders by the Boston Strangler, Jeffrey Dahmer, the Son of Sam, or Ted Bundy. They also do not have a plausible explanation for running amok, the indiscriminate killing of multiple people in public places, followed by suicide or killing of the perpetrator. Running amok was long considered to be an exotic, culture-bound syndrome limited to Malaysia. In the last several decades, it has been repeatedly observed in the Western industrial countries, including mass killing among teenagers on school campuses. There is also no plausible psychodynamic explanation for the religiously motivated combination of violence and suicide. In World War II, Japanese kamikaze warriors conducted suicidal missions to destroy American battleships and sacrifice their lives for their emperor, whom they considered to be God. In recent decades, Muslim fundamentalists have been committing mass murders, expecting to obtain blissful existence in the Muslim paradise as the reward for their actions. Current psychodynamic and psychosocial theories are even less convincing when it comes to bestial acts committed by entire groups, like the Sharon Tate murders of Charles Manson's gang, the My Lai massacre of more than 500 unarmed Vietnamese villagers by American soldiers, the torture and abuse of prisoners in the Abu Ghraib prison, and the atrocities that occur during prison uprisings. They fail completely when it comes to mass societal phenomena that involve entire nations, such as Nazism, communism, bloody wars and revolutions, genocide and concentration camps. Psychoanalytic theories do not explain Hitler's Holocaust, Stalin's Gulag Archipelago, and the mass murders of many millions of farmers, Ukrainians and Armenians, Mao's Cultural Revolution in China, and genocide in Tibet. Perinatal roots of violence. There is no doubt that traumatic experiences and the frustration of basic needs in childhood and infancy represent important sources of aggression. However, psychedelic research and deep experiential psychotherapies have revealed additional, much more significant roots of violence in the deep recesses of the human psyche that lie beyond or beneath postnatal biography. The feelings of vital threat, pain, and suffocation experienced for many hours during the passage through the birth canal generate enormous amounts of murderous aggression that remains repressed and stored in the organism. As Sigmund Freud pointed out in his book, Mourning and Melancholia, repressed aggression turns into depression and self-destructive impulses. Perinatal energies and emotions, by their very nature, represent a mixture of murderous and suicidal drives. The reliving of birth in various forms of experiential psychotherapy is not limited to the replay of the emotional feelings and physical sensations experienced during the passage through the birth canal. It is typically accompanied by a variety of experiences from the collective unconscious, portraying scenes of unimaginable violence. Among these are often powerful sequences depicting wars, revolutions, racial riots, concentration camps, totalitarianism, and genocide. Spontaneous emergence of this imagery, associated with the reliving of birth, suggests that the perinatal level might actually be an important source of extreme forms of human violence. Naturally, wars and revolutions are extremely complex phenomena that have historical, economic, political, religious, and other dimensions. My intention here is not to offer a reductionistic explanation replacing all the other causes, but to add some new insights concerning the psychological and spiritual dimensions of these forms of social psychopathology that have been neglected or received only cursory attention in earlier theories. The images of violent socio-political events accompanying the reliving of biological birth tend to appear in very specific connection with the four basic perinatal matrices, BPMs, associated with the reliving of the consecutive stages of the birth process. While reliving episodes of undisturbed intrauterine existence, BPM1, we typically experience images from human societies with an ideal social structure, from cultures that live in complete harmony with nature, or from future utopian societies where all major conflicts have been resolved. Memories of intrauterine disturbances, such as those of a toxic womb, RH incompatibility between the maternal organism and the fetus, imminent miscarriage, or attempted abortion are accompanied by images of human groups living in industrial areas where nature is polluted and spoiled, or in societies with insidious social order and all-pervading paranoia. Experiences associated with the first clinical stage of birth, BPM2, during which the uterus periodically contracts but the cervix is not yet open, present a diametrically different picture. They portray oppressive and abusive totalitarian societies with closed borders, victimizing their populations and choking personal freedom, such as Tsarist Russia, Stalin's Gulag Archipelago, Hitler's Third Reich, Eastern European Soviet satellites, Mao Zedong's China, South American military dictatorships, or South African apartheid. While experiencing these scenes, we experience emotional and physical torture. We identify exclusively with the victims and feel deep sympathy for the downtrodden and the underdog. It is impossible to imagine that this nightmarish situation will ever end. The experiences accompanying reliving of the second clinical stage of delivery, BPM3, When the cervix is dilated and continued contractions propel the fetus through the narrow passage of the birth canal, feature a rich panoply of violent scenes, bloody wars and revolutions, human or animal slaughter, mutilation, sexual abuse, and murder. These scenes often contain demonic elements and repulsive scatological motifs. Additional frequent concomitants of BPM-3 are visions of burning cities, rocket launches, and explosions of nuclear bombs. Here we are not limited to the role of victims, but can participate in three roles of the victim, the perpetrator, and an emotionally involved observer. The reliving of the third clinical stage of delivery, BPM-4, the actual moment of birth and the separation from the mother, is typically associated with images of victory in wars and revolutions, liberation of prisoners, and the success of collective efforts, such as patriotic or nationalistic movements. At this point, we can also experience visions of triumphant celebrations and parades or exciting post-war reconstruction. In 1975, I described these observations, linking socio-political phenomena to stages of biological birth, in my book Realms of the Human Unconscious. Shortly after its publication, I received an enthusiastic letter from Lloyd DeMoss, New York psychoanalyst and journalist, and one of the founders of psychohistory, which is a discipline that applies the findings of depth psychology to the study of history and political science. Psychohistorians explore such issues as the relationship between the childhood of political leaders and their system of values and the process of decision-making, or the influence of child-rearing practices on the nature of revolutions of that particular historical period. Lloyd DeMoss was very interested in my findings concerning the trauma of birth and its possible socio-political implications, because they provided independent support for his own research. For some time, DeMoss had been studying the psychodynamics of the periods immediately preceding wars and revolutions. He was interested in discovering how military leaders succeed in mobilizing masses of peaceful civilians and transforming them into killing machines practically overnight. His approach to this problem was very original and creative. In addition to the analysis of traditional historical sources, he drew data of great psychological importance from caricatures, jokes, dreams, personal imagery, slips of the tongue, side comments of speakers, and even doodles and scribbles on the edge of the rough drafts of political documents. By the time he contacted me, he had analyzed 17 situations preceding the outbreak of wars and revolutionary upheavals, spanning many centuries from antiquity to recent times. He was struck by the extraordinary abundance of figures of speech, metaphors, and images related to biological birth that he found in this material. Military leaders and politicians of all ages describing a critical situation or declaring war typically use terms that applied equally to perinatal distress. They accuse the enemy of choking and strangling their people, squeezing the last breath out of their lungs, constricting them, and not giving them enough space to live. Hitler's "Wir haben nicht genug Lebensraum," meaning "we don't have enough space to live." Equally frequent were allusions to dark caves, tunnels, and confusing labyrinths, dangerous abysses in which one might be pushed, and the threat of engulfment by treacherous quicksand or a terrifying whirlpool. Similarly, the offer for the crisis's resolution had the form of perinatal images. the leader promised to rescue his nation from an ominous labyrinth, to lead it to the light on the other side of the tunnel, and to create a situation where the dangerous aggressor and oppressor will be overcome and everybody will again breathe freely. Lloyd DeMoss's historical examples at the time included such famous personages as Alexander the Great, Napoleon Bonaparte, Samuel Adams, Kaiser Wilhelm II, Adolf Hitler, Nikita Khrushchev, and John F. Kennedy. Samuel Adams, talking about the American Revolution, referred to the child of independence now struggling for birth. In 1914, Kaiser Wilhelm stated that the monarchy has been seized by the throat and forced to choose between letting itself be strangled and making a last-ditch effort to defend itself against attack. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, Khrushchev wrote to Kennedy, pleading that the two nations not come to a clash like blind moles battling to death in a tunnel. Even more explicit was the coded message used by Japanese Ambassador Kurusu when he phoned Tokyo to signal that negotiations with Roosevelt had broken down and that it was all right to go ahead with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. He announced that the birth of the child is imminent and asked how things were in Japan. Does it seem as if the child might be born? The reply was, yes, the birth of the child seems imminent. Interestingly, the American intelligence listening in recognized the meaning of the war as birth code. More recent examples can be found in Osama bin Laden's videotape, where he threatens to turn the United States into a choking hell, and in the speech of U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, who described the acute crisis in Lebanon as birth pangs of the new Middle East. Particularly chilling was the use of perinatal language in connection with the explosion of the atomic bomb in Hiroshima. The airplane was given the name of the pilot's mother, Enola Gay. The atomic bomb itself carried a painted nickname, the Little Boy. And the agreed-upon message sent to Washington as a signal of successful detonation was, "The baby is born." It would not be too far-fetched to also see the image of a newborn behind the nickname of the Nagasaki bomb, Fat Man. Since the time of our correspondence, Lloyd DeMoss collected many additional historical examples and refined his thesis that the memory of the birth trauma plays an important role as a source of motivation for violent social activity. The relationship between nuclear warfare and birth is of such relevance that I would like to explore it further using the material from a fascinating paper by Carol Cohn, Sex and Death in the Rational World of the Defense Intellectuals. The defense intellectuals, DIs, are civilians who move in and out of government, working sometimes as administrative officials or consultants, sometimes at universities and think tanks. They create the theory that informs and legitimates U.S. nuclear strategic practice. Where to place the nuclear missiles? How to manage the arms race? How to deter the use of nuclear weapons? How to fight a nuclear war if the deterrence fails? What is the strategy of the first strike? And how to explain why it is not safe to live without nuclear weapons. Activist Daniel Ellsberg, author of the 1971 explosive book The Pentagon Papers, revealed the diabolical nature and apocalyptic scale of the doomsday schemes and scenarios of these individuals in his recent sequel, The Doomsday Machine. According to the experts' estimates, the first nuclear strike on the Soviet Union was expected to kill 370 million people in Europe, dying immediately or in the aftermath of this attack. Whether countries like Denmark and Sweden would survive would depend on the direction of the wind at that time. There is no doubt that American defense intellectuals have like-minded opponents on the other side. It is hard to believe that this is a story about our species. Carol Cohn attended a 2-week summer seminar on nuclear weapons, nuclear strategic doctrine, and arms control. She was so fascinated by what had transpired there that she spent the following year immersed in the almost entirely male world of defense intellectuals, except for the secretaries. She collected some extremely interesting facts that confirmed the perinatal dimension in nuclear warfare. In her own terminology, this material confirms the male birth and male creation as important motifs underlying the psychology of nuclear warfare. She uses the following historical examples to illustrate her point of view. In 1942, Ernest Lawrence sent a telegram to a Chicago group of physicists who were developing the nuclear bomb, which read, "Congratulations to the new parents. Can hardly wait to see the new arrival." At Los Alamos, the atom bomb was referred to as Oppenheimer's baby. Richard Feynman wrote in his article, Los Alamos from Below, that when he was temporarily on leave after his wife's death, he received a telegram that read, "The baby is expected on such and such a day." At Lawrence Livermore Laboratories, the hydrogen bomb was referred to as Teller's baby, although those who wanted to disparage Edward Teller's contribution claimed he was not the bomb's father, but its mother. They claim that Stanislav Ulam was the real father, as he had all the important ideas and conceived it. Teller only carried it after that. Terms related to motherhood were also used regarding the provision of nurturance, the maintenance of the missiles. General Grove sent a triumphant coded cable to Secretary of War Henry Stimson at the Potsdam Conference, reporting the success of the first atomic test. "Doctor has just returned most enthusiastic and confident that the little boy is as husky as his big brother. The light in his eyes was discernible from here to Highhold, Stimson's country home, and I could have heard his screams from here to my farm." Stimson, in turn, informed Churchill by writing him a note that read, "Babies satisfactorily born." William L. Lawrence, who witnessed the test of the first atomic bomb, wrote, "The big boom came about 100 seconds after the great flash, the first cry of a newborn world." Edward Teller's exultant telegram to Los Alamos, announcing the successful test of the hydrogen bomb Mike at the Eniwetok Atoll in the Marshall Islands, read, "It's a boy." According to Carol Cohn, male scientists gave birth to a progeny with the ultimate power of domination over female nature. Further support for the pivotal role of the perinatal domain of the unconscious in war psychology can be found in Sam Keen's excellent book, The Faces of the Enemy. Keen brought together an outstanding collection of war posters, propaganda cartoons, and caricatures from many historical periods and countries. He demonstrated that the way the enemy is described and portrayed during a war or revolution is a stereotype that shows only minimal variations and has very little to do with the actual characteristics of the country and its inhabitants. This material also typically disregards the diversity and heterogeneity characterizing the population of each country and makes blatant generalizations. This is what the Germans, Americans, Japanese, Russians, etc. are like. Keane was able to divide these images into several archetypal categories. He did not specifically refer to the perinatal domain of the unconscious, but the analysis of his picture material reveals a preponderance of symbolic images that are characteristic of BPM-2 and BPM-3. The enemy is typically depicted as a dangerous octopus, a vicious dragon, a multi-headed hydra, a giant venomous tarantula, an engulfing leviathan, or ominous snakes, particularly vipers and boa constrictors. Scenes depicting strangulation or crushing, ominous whirlpools, and treacherous quicksand also abound in pictures from the time of wars, revolutions, and political crises. The juxtaposition of pictures from holotropic states of consciousness that focus on the reliving of birth with the historical pictorial documentation collected by Lloyd DeMoss and Sam Keane represents strong evidence for the perinatal roots of human violence. According to the new insights provided jointly by observations from consciousness research and through the findings of psychohistory, we all carry in our deep unconscious powerful energies, emotions, and painful physical sensations associated with the trauma of birth that have not been adequately processed and assimilated. This aspect of our psyche can be completely unconscious for many people until and unless they embark on an in-depth self-exploration with the use of psychedelics or other powerful experiential techniques of psychotherapy, such as holotropic breathwork, primal therapy, or rebirthing. Others can have varying degrees of awareness of the perinatal level of the unconscious. The activation of this material can lead to serious individual psychopathology, including unmotivated violence. Lloyd DeMoss suggested that for unknown reasons, the influence of inner perinatal elements can increase simultaneously in a large number of people. This creates an atmosphere of general tension, anxiety, and anticipation. The leader is an individual who is under a stronger influence of the perinatal dynamics than an average person. He also has the ability to disown his unacceptable feelings, the shadow in Jung's terminology, and to project them onto the external situation. The collective discomfort is blamed on the enemy, and a military intervention is offered as a solution. In his groundbreaking book, Cosmos and Psyche, Richard Tarnas presented fascinating material that might throw interesting light on the problem of increased collective tension preceding the onset of wars and revolutions as described by DeMoss. In his meticulous historical research, which extended for more than 30 years, Tarnas was able to show that throughout history, wars and revolutions showed correlations with specific astrological transits. His findings strongly suggest that archetypal forces play a critical role in shaping human history. Wars and revolutions provide an opportunity to disregard the psychological defenses that ordinarily keep the dangerous unconscious forces in check. Superego, the psychological force that demands restraint and civilized behavior, is replaced by what Freud called war superego. We receive praise and medals for violence, murder, indiscriminate destruction, and pillaging, the same behaviors that in peacetime are unacceptable and would land us in prison or worse. Similarly, sexual violence has been a common practice during wartime and has been generally tolerated. As a matter of fact, military leaders have often promised their soldiers unlimited sexual access to women in the besieged cities and conquered territories to motivate them for battle. Once the war erupts, the destructive and self-destructive perinatal impulses are freely acted out. The themes that we normally encounter in certain stages of the process of inner exploration and transformation, BPM 2 and 3, now become parts of our everyday life, either directly or in the form of television news. Various no-exit situations, sadomasochistic orgies and sexual violence, bestial and demonic behavior, the unleashing of enormous explosive energies and scatological scenes which belong to standard perinatal imagery, are all enacted in wars and revolutions with extraordinary vividness and power. Witnessing scenes of destruction and acting out of violent unconscious impulses, whether it occurs on the individual scale or collectively in wars and revolutions, does not result in healing and transformation as it would in an inner confrontation with these elements in a therapeutic context. The experience is not generated by our own unconscious, lacks the element of deep introspection, and does not lead to insights. The situation is fully externalized, and the connection with the deep dynamics of the psyche is missing. Naturally, there is also no therapeutic intention and motivation for change and transformation. Thus, the goal of the underlying birth fantasy, which represents the deepest driving force of such violent events, is not achieved, even if the war or revolution has been brought to a successful closure. The most triumphant external victory does not deliver what was expected and hoped for, an inner sense of emotional liberation and psycho-spiritual rebirth. Since many of the clients with whom I worked in Prague had experienced both the Nazi occupation and the Stalinist regime, the work with them generated some fascinating insights into the relationship between perinatal dynamics and the institution of both the Nazi concentration camps and communism. As we have all seen throughout history, after the intoxicating initial feelings of triumph when the revolution is won, there comes at first a sober awakening and later bitter disappointment. It usually does not take long until a facsimile of the old oppressive system starts emerging from the ruins of the dead dream. Since the destructive and self-destructive forces have not been resolved and continue to operate in the unconscious of everyone involved. This happens again and again in human history, whether the event involved is the French Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, the Communist Revolution in China, or any of the other violent upheavals associated with great hopes and expectations. Insights and issues related to communist ideology typically emerged in the treatment of my clients at the time when they were struggling with perinatal energies and emotions. It soon became obvious that the passionate fervor that revolutionaries feel toward the oppressors and their regimes also receives a powerful psychological reinforcement from their revolt against the inner prison of their perinatal memories. Conversely, the need to coerce and dominate others is an external displacement of the need to overcome the fear of being overwhelmed by one's own unconscious. The murderous entanglement of the oppressor and the revolutionary is thus an externalized replica of the situation experienced in the birth canal. A similar emotional entanglement also seems to exist between criminals and police. The communist vision contains an element of psychological truth that has made it appealing to large numbers of people. The basic notion that a violent experience of a revolutionary nature is necessary to terminate suffering and oppression, and institute a situation of greater harmony is correct when understood as related to the process of reliving birth and the ensuing inner transformation. However, it is dangerously false when it is projected on the external world as a political ideology of violent revolutions. The fallacy lies in the fact that what on a deeper level is essentially an archetypal pattern of psycho-spiritual death and rebirth takes the form of an atheistic and anti-spiritual program. Paradoxically, communism has many features in common with organized religions in that it exploits people's spiritual needs, while not only failing to satisfy them, but actively suppressing any genuine spiritual search. The parallel of communism with organized religion goes so far that Stalin, at the height of his power, was declared infallible, even though he was expressing authoritative opinions in disciplines in which he had no actual knowledge. Communist revolutions have been extremely successful in their destructive phase, but instead of creating the promised ideal utopian society, their victories bred regimes in which oppression, cruelty, and injustice ruled supreme. After the economically ruined and politically corrupt Soviet Union collapsed and the communist world fell apart, it became obvious to all people with sane judgment that this giant historical experiment, conducted at the cost of tens of millions of human lives and unimaginable human suffering, was a colossal failure. If the above observations are correct, no external interventions have a chance to create a better world unless they are associated with a profound transformation of human beings. The observations from the study of holotropic states also threw some important light on the psychology of Nazism and concentration camps. Over a number of years, Professor Jan Bastiaans in Leiden, Holland, conducted LSD therapy with people suffering from concentration camp syndrome, a condition that developed in former inmates many years after their incarceration. Bastiaans also worked with former capos, concentration camp prisoners given authority over other prisoners by the SS, on their issues of profound guilt. An artistic description of this work can be found in the book Shiviti, written by a former inmate, Ka Tsetnik, 135633, who underwent a series of therapeutic sessions with Bastiaans. Bastiaans himself wrote a paper describing his work called Man in the Concentration Camp and the Concentration Camp in Man. There he pointed out, without specifying it, that the concentration camps are a projection of a certain domain which exists in the human unconscious. Before there was a man in the concentration camp, there was a concentration camp in man. The study of holotropic states of consciousness makes it possible to identify the realm of the psyche Bastiaans was talking about. The perinatal domain of the unconscious certainly fits his description. Closer examination of the general and specific conditions in the Nazi concentration camps reveals that they were a diabolical and realistic enactment of the nightmarish atmosphere that characterizes the reliving of biological birth. The barbed wire barriers, high voltage fences, watchtowers with submachine guns, minefields, and packs of trained dogs certainly created a hellish and almost archetypal image of an utterly hopeless and oppressive, no-exit situation that is characteristic of BPM-2. At the same time, the elements of violence, bestiality, scatology, and sexual abuse of women and men, including rape and sadistic practices, all belong to the phenomenology of BPM-3. In concentration camps, the sexual abuse happened at random on the individual level, as well as in the context of the House of Dolls, institutions providing entertainment for the officers. The only escape out of this hell was death, whether by a bullet, hunger, disease, or suffocation in the gas chambers. The books by K. Tsetnik, 135633, House of Dolls, and Sunrise Over Hell, offer a shattering description of the life in the concentration camps. The bestiality of the SS seemed to have been focused particularly on pregnant women and little children, which brings further support for the perinatal hypothesis. The most powerful passage from Terence Dupré's book, The Survivor, is without any doubt the description of a truck full of babies dumped into a fire, followed by a scene in which pregnant women are beaten with clubs and whips, torn by dogs, dragged around by the hair, kicked in the bellies, and then thrown into the crematorium while still alive. The perinatal nature of the irrational impulses manifesting in the camps is also evident in the scatological behavior of the SS. Throwing eating bowls into the latrines and asking the inmates to retrieve them, and forcing the inmates to urinate into each other's mouths were practices that, besides their bestiality, brought the danger of epidemics. Had the concentration camps been simply institutions for the isolation of political enemies and for providing cheap slave labor, maintenance of hygienic rules would have been a primary concern of the organizers, as is the case in any facility accommodating large numbers of people. In Buchenwald alone, as a result of these perverted practices, 27 inmates drowned in feces in the course of a single month. The convincing depth and intensity of many experiences of collective violence that contain such perinatal features suggests that they originate in the deep unconscious. When our experiential self-exploration reaches the memory of the birth trauma, we connect with an immense pool of painful memories of the human species and gain access to other people's experiences who were once in a similar predicament. It is not hard to imagine that the perinatal level of our unconscious, which knows so intimately the history of human violence, is actually partially responsible for wars, revolutions, genocide, and similar atrocities. The nature and scope of the brutalities of human history associated with perinatal experiences is truly astonishing. Christopher Bache, after having carefully analyzed various aspects of this phenomenon, came to an interesting conclusion. He suggests that the memory of the violence perpetrated throughout the ages in human history have contaminated the field of collective unconscious in the same way in which the traumas from our infancy and childhood pollute our individual unconscious. According to Bache, it might be possible that when we start experiencing these collective memories, our inner process transcends the framework of personal therapy, and we participate in the cleansing and healing of the field of consciousness of the human species. The role of the birth trauma as a source of violence and self-destructive tendencies has been confirmed by clinical studies. For example, there seems to be an important correlation between difficult birth and criminality. In a similar way, aggression directed inward, particularly suicide, seems to be psychogenetically linked to a difficult birth. The Scandinavian researcher Bertil Jakobsen found a close correlation between specific forms of self-destructive behavior and the type of birth. Suicides involving asphyxiation were associated with suffocation at birth. Violent suicides with mechanical birth trauma, and drug addiction that led to suicide with opiate and/or barbiturate administration during labor. Transpersonal roots of violence. The research of holotropic states has revealed that the roots of human violence reach even deeper than the perinatal level of the psyche. Significant additional sources of aggression can be found in the transpersonal domain, including scenes of torture and killing in past life experiences, mythological figures of wrathful deities and demonic entities, and grand archetypal destructive scenes, such as the Nordic Ragnarok, the doom or twilight of the gods. Archangel Michael fighting the demonic hordes. Zoroastrian battle of Ahura Mazda's forces of light against Ahriman's forces of darkness. Or the apocalypse from the New Testament. C.G. Jung showed that the archetypes of the collective unconscious have a powerful influence not only on the behavior of individuals, but also on the events of human history. From his point of view, entire nations and cultural groups might be enacting important archetypal themes in their behavior. Jung believed that many aspects of the German Nazi movement could be understood as possession of the German nation by the archetype of Wotan, an ancient god of storm and frenzy. In his brilliant book, A Terrible Love of War, James Hillman amassed convincing evidence that war is a formidable archetypal force that has irresistible power over individuals and nations. In many instances, military, political, and religious leaders use not only perinatal, but also archetypal images and spiritual symbolism to achieve their goals. Medieval crusaders were asked to sacrifice their lives for Jesus in a war that would recover the Holy Land from the Mohammedans. Adolf Hitler exploited the mythological motifs of the supremacy of the Nordic race and of the millennial empire, as well as the ancient Vedic symbols of the swastika and the solar eagle. Ayatollah Khomeini and Osama bin Laden ignited the imagination of their Muslim followers by references to jihad, the holy war against the infidels. American President Ronald Reagan referred to the Soviet Union as the evil empire, and George W. Bush used references to the Axis of Evil and Armageddon in his political speeches. Carol Cohn discussed not only the perinatal in her paper, but also the transpersonal symbolism associated with the language used in relation to nuclear weaponry and doctrine. The authors of the strategic doctrine refer to members of their community as the nuclear priesthood. The first atomic test was called Trinity, as in the unity of Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, the male forces of creation. From her feminist perspective, Cohn saw this as an effort by male scientists to appropriate and claim ultimate creative power. The scientists who worked on the atomic bomb and witnessed the test described it in the following way. It was as though we stood at the first day of creation. Robert Oppenheimer thought of Krishna's words to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, "I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." Biographical determinants of greed. Sigmund Freud saw greed as a phenomenon related to problems during the nursing period. According to him, frustration or overindulgence during the oral phase of libidinal development can reinforce the primitive, infantile need to incorporate objects to such an extent that in adulthood, it is transferred in a sublimated form to a variety of other objects and situations. When the acquisitive drive focuses on money, psychoanalysts attribute it to fixation on the anal stage of libidinal development. This is based on Freud's discovery of a symbolic association between feces and gold. Insatiable sexual appetite is then considered to be the result of phallic fixation. Many other unrelenting human pursuits are then interpreted in terms of sublimation of such phallic instinctual urges. Modern consciousness research has found these interpretations to be superficial and inadequate. It has discovered significant additional sources of acquisitiveness and greed on the perinatal and transpersonal levels of the unconscious. Perinatal sources of greed. In the course of biographically oriented psychotherapy, many people discover that their life has been inauthentic in certain specific sectors of interpersonal relations. For example, problems with parental authority can lead to specific patterns of difficulty with authority figures. Repeated dysfunctional patterns in sexual relationships can be traced to parents as models for sexual behavior. Strong sibling rivalry can color and distort future peer relationships, and so on. When the process of experiential self-exploration reaches the perinatal level, we typically discover that our life up to that point has been largely inauthentic in its totality, not just in certain partial segments. We find, to our surprise and astonishment, that our entire life strategy has been misdirected and therefore incapable of providing genuine satisfaction. The reason for this is that we were primarily motivated in our choices and our behavior by our fear of death and by unconscious forces associated with biological birth, which we had not adequately processed and integrated. In other words, during biological birth, we completed the process physically, but not emotionally. When our field of consciousness is strongly influenced by the underlying memory of the struggle in the birth canal, it leads to a feeling of discomfort and dissatisfaction with the present situation. This discontent can focus on a large spectrum of issues: unsatisfactory physical appearance, inadequate resources and material possessions, low social position and influence, insufficient amount of power and fame, and many others. Like the fetus stuck in the birth canal, we feel a strong drive and urge to get to a better situation that lies somewhere in the future. Whatever the reality of our present circumstances, we do not find them satisfactory. Our fantasies keep creating images of a future situation that appears more fulfilling than the present one. It seems that until we reach it, our life will only be preparation for a better future, not the kind of life we want or feel we should have. This results in a life pattern that people involved in experiential self-exploration have described as a treadmill or rat race type of existence. Existentialist philosophers talk about auto-projecting into the future. This strategy is a basic fallacy of human life. It is essentially a losing strategy, whether or not we achieve the goals that we have set for ourselves, since these external goals cannot deliver the satisfaction that we expect from them. We can never get enough of the substitutes that we don't really want or need. When the goal is not reached, the continuing dissatisfaction is attributed to the fact that we have failed to reach the aspired corrective state. When we do succeed in reaching the goal of our aspirations, it also typically does not have much influence on our basic life feelings. The continuing dissatisfaction is then blamed either on the fact that the choice of the goal was not correct or that it was not ambitious enough. The result is either substitution of the old goal with a different one, or an augmented version of the same type of goal. In any case, the failure is not correctly diagnosed as being an inevitable result of a fundamentally wrong strategy of life that is incapable of providing satisfaction. This fallacious pattern, applied on a large scale, is responsible for the reckless, irrational pursuit of various grandiose goals that results in great suffering and problems in the world. This unfulfilling pursuit of various goals can be played out on any level of affluence, importance, and fame, since it never brings true satisfaction. Joseph Campbell described this situation as reaching the top of the ladder, then finding that it is leaning against the wrong wall. The only strategy that can significantly reduce this irrational drive is full conscious reliving and integration of the trauma of birth in systematic inner self-exploration and reaching the nourishing memories of the completed birth, BPM 4, the good womb, BPM 1, and positive transpersonal states. Transpersonal roots of insatiable greed. Modern consciousness research and experiential psychotherapy have discovered that the deepest source of our dissatisfaction and striving for perfection is ultimately transpersonal in nature. In Dante Alighieri's words, "The desire for perfection is that desire which always makes every pleasure appear incomplete, for there is no joy or pleasure so great in this life that it can quench the thirst in our soul." In the most general sense, the deepest transpersonal roots of insatiable greed can best be understood in terms of Ken Wilber's concept of the Atman Project. Our true nature is divine. Brahman, Buddha, the Tao, God, cosmic Christ, Allah. And although the process of incarnation separates and alienates us from our source, the awareness of this fact is never completely lost. The deepest motivating force of the psyche on all levels of consciousness evolution is to return to the experience of our divinity. However, the constraining conditions which surround the consecutive stages of ego development stand in the way of attaining this experience. Real transcendence requires the death of the separate self, dying to the exclusive autonomous subject. Due to the fear of annihilation and grasping onto the ego, the individual has to settle for Atman substitutes or surrogates, which are specific for each particular stage. For the fetus and the newborn, this means the satisfaction experienced in the good womb or on the good breast. For an infant, this is the experience of age-specific physiological satisfaction and security. For the adult, the range of possible Atman projects is large. Besides food and sex, it also includes money, fame, power, appearance, knowledge, and many others. Since our deep sense that our true identity is the totality of cosmic creation and the creative principle itself, substitutes of any degree and scope, the Atman projects, will always remain unsatisfactory. Only the experience of our divinity in a holotropic state of consciousness can ever fulfill our deepest need. The ultimate solution for insatiable greed is in the inner world, not in secular pursuits of any kind. The great 13th century Persian mystic and poet Rumi made it very clear. "All the hopes, desires, loves and affections that people have for different things. Fathers, mothers, friends, heavens, the earth, gardens, palaces, sciences, works, food, drink. The saint knows that these are desires for God, and all those things are veils. When men leave this world and see the king without these veils, then they will know that all were veils and coverings, that the object of their desire was in reality that one thing. Psychology of survival. The insights from consciousness research and from transpersonal psychology can be put to practical use in alleviating the crisis we are facing in the modern world. This work has shown that the roots of human violence are much deeper and more formidable than traditional psychology ever imagined. However, it has also discovered extremely effective therapeutic strategies that have the potential to assuage and transform the human propensity toward violence. Efforts to change humanity would have to start with psychological prevention at a very early age. The data from prenatal and perinatal psychology indicate that much could be achieved by changing the conditions of pregnancy, delivery, and early postnatal care. This would include improving the emotional preparation of the mother during pregnancy, practicing natural childbirth, creating a psycho-spiritually informed birth environment, and cultivating emotionally nourishing contact between the mother and the child in the postpartum period. The circumstances of birth play an important role in creating a disposition to violence and self-destructive tendencies, or conversely, to loving behavior and healthy interpersonal relationships. French obstetrician Michel Audon has shown how the hormones involved in the birth process and in nursing and maternal behavior, the catecholamines, adrenaline and noradrenaline, play an important role in the stress of the labor, and in evolution they functioned as mediators of the mother's fight-or-flight response when birth was occurring in unprotected natural environments with dangerous predators. Oxytocin, prolactin, and endorphins are known to induce parental behavior in animals and foster dependency and attachment. Today, the environment of the delivering mothers is physically safe, but the busy, noisy, and chaotic milieu of many hospitals induces anxiety and unnecessarily engages the catecholamine system. It imprints the picture of a world that is potentially dangerous and requires aggressive responses in the mind of the newborn. This interferes with the hormones that mediate positive inter-individual imprinting and bonding. It is therefore essential to provide a quiet, safe, and private environment for birthing. Much has been written about the importance of child-rearing and about disastrous emotional consequences of traumatic conditions in infancy and childhood. Certainly, this is an area where continued education and guidance are necessary. However, to apply the theoretically known principles, the parents must themselves reach sufficient emotional stability and maturity. It is well known that emotional problems are passed from generation to generation like a curse. Humanistic and transpersonal psychologies have developed effective experiential methods of self-exploration, healing, and personality transformation. Some of these come from Western therapeutic traditions, while others represent modern adaptations of ancient and native spiritual practices. Besides offering emotional healing, these approaches have the potential to return genuine experiential spirituality into Western culture and overcome the alienation of modern humanity. Some of these approaches have a very favorable ratio between professional helpers and clients, and others use the healing potential of the group dynamics. Systematic, responsible work with psychedelics and other forms of holotropic states of consciousness can bring more than healing of emotional and psychosomatic disorders. It can facilitate deep psycho-spiritual transformation and changes in the hierarchy of values. This includes a significant decrease of aggression, as well as the development of compassion, a sense of inner peace, improved self-image, self-acceptance, and the acceptance of others. Some of these changes are identical with those that Abraham Maslow described in people who had experienced spontaneous mystical states, peak experiences, such as self-actualization and self-realization, a genuine sense for truth, beauty, and goodness, meta-values, and a tendency to incorporate these virtues into one's life, meta-motivations. People involved in responsible psychonautics also describe increased zest, joie de vivre, and an enhanced ability to enjoy the simple things in life, such as walks in nature, listening to music, interacting with other people, lovemaking, and savoring food. As the content of the perinatal level of the unconscious emerges into consciousness and is integrated, it results in radical personality changes. The experience of psycho-spiritual death and rebirth, and a conscious connection with positive postnatal and prenatal memories, reduce irrational drives and ambitions. This causes a shift in emphasis from the past and future to the present moment. Some of these changes have important implications for human society at large. One frequent result of responsible psychonautics is the increase of racial, sexual, political, and religious tolerance. Differences among people appear to be interesting and enriching, rather than threatening, whether they are related to gender, race, color, language, political conviction, or religious belief. Another frequent change is the replacement of competitiveness with synergy and cooperation. Many psychonauts discover the power and efficacy of the Taoist Wu Wei, creative quietude, doing by being, when life is not governed by ambitious drives and begins to resemble instead the soft martial arts or surfing. With this life strategy, more is accomplished with less effort, and the results are not only personally satisfying, but also serve the larger community. Very frequently, this can be associated with remarkable helpful synchronicities, such as the unexpected appearance of the right people, information, and resources. The process of spiritual opening and transformation typically deepens further as a result of transpersonal experiences. The changes in people who have them resemble those that astronauts and cosmonauts experienced as a result of their space travels. The remarkable effect that cosmic space has on astronauts was evident in the stories of 8 American astronauts in Michael Lemley's remarkable documentary, The Other Side of the Moon, including Louis Armstrong, Edgar Mitchell, Buzz Aldrin, and Rusty Schweikart. Like the astronauts, psychonauts start seeing the Earth as a beautiful blue jewel, shining in the dark night of the giant cosmos. And as Buckminster Fuller's spaceship Earth, which all of humanity shares. This leads to a feeling that all of us are global citizens before we are Russians, Czechs, Germans, or Americans. Identification with other people, entire human groups, animals, and plant life tends to bring a sense of wonder and love of nature and of all creation. This is based on an almost cellular awareness that the boundaries in the universe are arbitrary, and that each of us is ultimately identical with the entire web of existence. It becomes evident how deeply we are embedded in nature, and that we cannot damage the natural environment, polluting the air, the water, and the soil where we grow our food, without damaging ourselves. This awareness leads to great ecological sensitivity and determination to protect nature. Last but not least, responsible psychonautics tends to awaken spirituality of a non-denominational, non-chauvinistic, universal, all-encompassing, and mystical nature that is very authentic and convincing because it is based on deep personal experience. It has the power to undermine and replace both the atheistic, monistic, materialist worldview and rigid fundamentalist belief systems, which are founded on the literal understanding of religious scriptures. It is obvious that the inner transformation described previously would increase our chances for survival if it could occur on a sufficiently large scale. Many of the people with whom we have worked saw humanity at a critical crossroad, facing either collective annihilation or an evolutionary jump in consciousness of unprecedented proportions. Psychedelic pioneer Terence McKenna put it very succinctly. The history of the silly monkey is over, one way or another. Our species either undergoes a profound inner transformation or may face extinction. The history of the silly monkey is over, one way or another. Our species either undergoes a profound inner transformation or may face extinction. We seem to be involved in a dramatic race for time that has no precedent in the entire history of humanity. What is at stake is nothing less than the future of our species and of life on this planet. If we continue the old strategies, which are clearly extremely destructive and self-destructive, it is unlikely that the human species will survive. However, if a sufficient number of people could undergo the process of deep inner psycho-spiritual transformation, we might reach a level of consciousness evolution that would lead us to deserve the name we have so proudly given to our species, Homo sapiens sapiens.